Every culture has its own unique sayings. There is one I only came across a couple of years ago, and it may just be common to Northern Ireland, so I'm not sure whether it's been popular for many years or whether I was just moving in the wrong circles, but it always makes me smile. It's the phrase, "There's wiser chewing grass in that field." It took me a while to catch on. It was referring to cows and sheep. Common sense isn't that common. That's another expression that bemoans the fact that people sometimes do crazy things that don't make any sense. And while cultures may have different ways of expressing wise sayings with a colloquial twist, many common sayings are actually direct quotes from the Old Testament. Have you ever heard the expression "out of the mouth of babes and sucklings"? I, for one, had always assumed that the expression was from Shakespeare, but it is in fact a direct quotation from Psalm 8, verse 2, "Out of the mouths of babes and children you have ordained praise." Pride comes before a fall. It's probably more instantly recognizable as a phrase attributed to King Solomon, who compiled what's often referred to as the wisdom literature of the Bible, namely the books of Job, Proverbs, Song of Songs, and Ecclesiastes. The words of wisdom, however, were not limited to wise old Solomon. In fact, some may even question Solomon's wisdom, marrying 700 wives and supporting 300 concubines. But he certainly actively sought out wise sayings and he recorded them for posterity. You were probably surprised to hear Job classified as wisdom literature, but some very well-known phrases, such as "nothing but skin and bone" and "I escaped by the skin of my teeth," are lifted straight from this book. And if you want a reference, it's Job chapter 19, verses 19 and 20. Any ideas where the expression "a fly in the ointment" can be found? It's at the very start of Ecclesiastes chapter 10. As dead flies cause even a bottle of the perfumer's ointment to stink, so even a little foolishness spoils great wisdom and honor. So let that be a warning to us all. If you have a teenager living under your roof, then you may well have used this next expression without even realizing that you are actually quoting Isaiah chapter 60. "Rise and shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you." And while the phrase "a little birdie told me" doesn't appear directly in the Bible, Solomon did warn in Ecclesiastes 10, verse 20, "Never make light of the king, even in your thoughts, and don't make fun of the powerful, even in your bedroom, for a little bird might deliver your message and tell them what you said." It's wonderful that biblical truth is still quoted in everyday conversation by people who might never open a Bible to seek truth, but without revelation, the people perish. See what I did there? So truth can also be misconstrued without proper understanding. One phrase that is often quoted out of context is "an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth." The phrase "an eye for an eye" has been used countless times as the title for fictional dramas about crime and retribution. But the phrase "an eye for an eye," found in Exodus 21, was never intended to encourage payback or taking the law into our own hands. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth simply meant that the penalty should always fit the crime and not go beyond it. Another phrase that has become a little twisted over time is the observation that there is no rest for the wicked. No rest for the wicked is actually a direct quote from Isaiah 57, verse 20, which states that there is no shalom, there is no peace, there is no rest, there is no contentment for the wicked, says my God. But that isn't how we like to quote it. How many times have you been in a situation where you've observed a close friend or a family member struggling to stay on top of all the demands put upon them? And you've just stopped in time from saying, "no rest for the wicked," and changed it to, "no rest for the weary," as if that makes it less offensive. No rest for the wicked isn't something that we should be speaking out over anyone as a glib comment, for death and life are in the power of the tongue. And twisting it to say, "no rest for the weary," that is just plain twisted. What does that phrase even mean? No rest for the weary? No rest or peace for the wicked makes sense, but to misquote the phrase and say, "no rest for the weary," is nothing more than a trite misquotation which doesn't actually mean anything other than implying that if you're weary, don't expect to get any help. Don't try to seek help or take a break. If you are weary, you must keep going. That is not the way of God. Which brings me to the title of today's message. There are actually two types of rest in the Bible, a time to rest and a place to rest, and they are quite different. So, a time and a place, a time to rest and a place to rest. Victor spoke a few months back on the Sabbath rest, and it always seems to be a bone of contention here in Northern Ireland between those who value a day off and those who want the freedom to be able to spend their day working or spending their money in shops and restaurants with other people working for them. It's a very contentious issue, as no one likes to be told what they can or cannot do with their own time and their resources. And I concede that not everyone goes to church, but everyone still needs a day off. Our bodies are not machines. God could have created us to work 24/7, 365.25 days a year, but he didn't. He wanted us to live balanced lives, working to live, not living to work. Have you ever found that people nearly wear their busyness as a badge of honour, as if they will be respected because they're too busy to spend quality time with loved ones? We are living in crazy times. But there is a time for rest, and that is what is known as the Sabbath, or in Hebrew, the Shabbat rest. Have you ever thought about what the word Sabbath actually means? Maybe the word makes you think of a rigid, austere list of do's and don'ts. You can do this, but you can't do that. But the word Sabbath meant something quite different. Sabbath was never meant to be equated with legislation that parks be closed and the swings be tied up to prevent families from enjoying time together. That actually has happened for many years here in Ballymena. Sabbath doesn't even mean Sunday, for the Jewish Sabbath is on a Saturday. The Hebrew word Shabbat simply means to cease working, to rest, and to celebrate. Genesis chapter 2 describes how by the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on that day, he rested from all his work. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it. God knew when enough was enough. For he is the God of enough. That is what the name El Shaddai means, the all-sufficient one, the God of enough. While we may sometimes feel that our lives are out of control, that too many demands are being put upon us, there is a lesson there to remember that God is El Shaddai, the God of enough. And if we look to him, then he will bring our circumstances out of chaos and back into alignment. El Shaddai, the God of enough, he knew when to stop creating on the seventh day. And six chapters in the account of the flood, we see that again, God was the God of enough, knowing when to cease destroying, when he made a covenantal that never again would he allow the earth to be destroyed, the covenantal sign being the rainbow, of course. Genesis 8, verse 1. But God remembered Noah and all the wild animals and livestock with him in the boat. He sent a wind to blow across the earth, and the floodwaters began to recede. And then further down the chapter, in verse 20 of chapter 8, that then Noah built an altar to the Lord. And the Lord was pleased with the aroma of the sacrifice and said to himself, I will never again curse the ground because of the human race. Even though everything they think or imagine is bent towards evil from childhood, I will never again destroy all living things. As long as the earth remains, there will be planting and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night. Summer and winter, day and night, seasons and festivals, fastings and feastings. The rest wasn't just one day a week. I've been researching recently how the months on the Hebrew calendar are all based around the lunar months. At one time, in fact, our calendar was also based on lunar months, where the new moon instigated the beginning of a new month. In fact, our English word month is derived from the word moon. But then our months became more static as the Gregorian calendar was introduced, and the influence of the Roman Empire resulted in us naming our calendar months after the Roman gods, leaders, numbers, and festivals. It was decreed by the Emperor Julius Caesar, hence he chose to dedicate July to himself and August to his great nephew, Caesar Augustus. In the Bible, you'll actually find the days of the week are referred to simply as the first day, the seventh day, the third day, etc. And the only day of the week which had a specific name was the Sabbath, the Shabbat. And then we also find the Lord's Day mentioned. But once again, we see the influence of the Roman Empire, with the days of our week named after the Roman gods, Thor, Thursday, and Woden, or Odin as he appears in the North, in the Norse pantheon, being celebrated and commemorated midweek as Wednesday or Woden's Day. No surprise, Sunday and Monday were named after the sun and the moon. Most of the world has now followed suit and standardized its months in line with Roman rule to either 30 or 31 days, with February fluctuating between 28, 29 days. But the Hebrew calendar is still based on the appearance of the new moon, and a new moon will appear approximately every 29 and a half days. That's why Easter is not the same date every year, as we still look to the Hebrew calendar for a date for Easter, which coincides with the Jewish Passover celebration. Until relatively recently, well, 1500 years ago, the date of the new moon was declared by the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem. And once the appearance of the new moon had been verified by two witnesses, the Rosh Chodesh, or first of the month holiday, was announced. Today it can be calculated when a new moon, Today it can be calculated when a new moon will rise, so Jews are less reliant on an actual observation of the crescent moon. But imagine having an extra day off to celebrate the first day of every month. There's a lot going for the Hebrew calendar, I can tell you. We're currently in the month of Av in the Hebrew calendar, and it's a very significant month, as the ninth day of Av, which corresponded with the 6th of August, it began the 6th of August running into the 7th of August on our Gregorian calendar, marked the end of 3 weeks of mourning by the Jewish people, as they remembered many significant but tragic events that happened throughout world history on that day. Now, if you're going to check out these events, remember that the Hebrew calendar is based upon the appearance of a new moon rather than a static set date. So the 9th of Av in 2022 began at sunset on the 6th of August, whereas the 9th of Av last year began at sunset on the 17th of July. So it can occur at any time within about a month or 29 odd days. If you Google the date, the 9th of Av, that's spelled A-V, with Ab or Av meaning father in Hebrew, in 1914, you will find that that was the day World War I began. The earliest 9th of Av on record was much earlier than that. According to Jewish history, the curse of the 9th of Av can be traced right back to 1313 BC. That's a very easy date to remember, 1313 BC, when the spies entered from Canaan, or the spies returned from Canaan with a bad report that the land was unconquerable. And the Israelites then began a period of 38 years wandering around the wilderness. And the generation that had left Egypt would actually die rather than crossing over into their promised land. The 9th of Av, 423 BC, is the date when King Solomon's temple in Jerusalem was destroyed by the Babylonians. 500 years later, on the 9th of Av, 69 AD, the second temple was destroyed by Roman soldiers. 64 years later, and a rebel leader by the name of Shimon bar Kochba, who many Jews believe to be their long-awaited Messiah, led a revolt against Roman rule in Jerusalem. The revolt continued for almost 2 years, so it's not as if he'd started it on the wrong day. It lasted 2 years, culminating with what would become known as the Siege of Betar, a bloody siege led by Hadrian, who entered Betar with 80,000 troops, slaughtering every man, woman, and child until the blood flowed from the doorways and the sewers. It's said that horses were up to their necks in blood, and the blood could be seen for, it was actually like a blood entering the sea for 2.5 miles. The siege took place on the 9th of Av, 135 AD. Why am I recounting all of these tragic events? The 9th of Av is considered the saddest day on the Jewish calendar, and it's commemorated every year with 3 weeks of mourning. Yet every Saturday, which is the Jewish Sabbath, during those 3 weeks of mourning, Jews would be encouraged to pause, to rest, to celebrate, and not to fast. In fact, they would be told to eat richer food than normal. During the 3 weeks prior to the 9th of Av, Jews would not buy new clothes. This still continues to this day. Many Jews will not buy new clothes or have their hair cut, and there would be no wedding celebrations with live music. But on the Sabbath, all the laws of mourning were suspended, and Jews would be reminded to eat meat and drink wine and celebrate. We need to get away from this idea that the Shabbat, or the Sabbath as we call it in English, is a time to abstain from the goodness of God. The Shabbat was a time to celebrate and cease from work, to remember that God is El Shaddai, the God of enough, the all-sufficient one. When we refuse to take a Shabbat rest, then we are revealing that we don't really trust God, and we are more reliant on our own abilities and our own resources. Essentially, we're actually saying we have a better plan than God's plan. We don't need to think about God's plan. We're independent. We're more powerful in our own eyes than God. We're too proud to rest and trust God. We are making ourselves higher than God. And there's a word for that in the Old Testament, idolatry. Psalm 127, verse 2 warns us, "It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of anxious toil, for he gives his beloved sleep." Yes, we may occasionally need to rise up early to catch an early flight or stay up late to finish a project, but that should not be the norm. Are we constantly in a state of anxious toil, or do we know the blessing of living within the boundaries that God has set for our lives, and that most definitely includes rest? Even in biblical times, there was a tension between fully appreciating that the Sabbath was intended to bring blessing and a religious spirit that wanted to control and reduce life down to a rigid set of rules. We have a copy of the letter which the Apostle Paul wrote to the early church in Colossae. And in one section, he specifically addresses the issue of Sabbath. We find his advice in Colossians 2, verse 16. "Therefore, do not let anyone judge you in regard to food, or in regard to drink, or in regard to a feast, or a new moon, or Sabbaths." Life can get in the way. Your ox could fall into a ditch. Maybe it's not likely to happen to anyone listening today, but it could happen. Or your job might require you to work or travel for work on Sundays. But the actual day is less important than the fact that we shouldn't work 6 days without taking a seventh day to rest and spend time with him, trusting him to supply our needs. Excuse me. God is not nearly as concerned about which day we take to rest, so long as we take one. It's foolishness to do otherwise. Sorry about that. But as I said earlier, there is a time and a place. A time to rest and a place to rest. We've looked at the Shabbat or the Sabbath rest, and I've also referred to some of the times and seasons of rest in the Jewish calendar, such as the monthly Rosh Chodesh, which marks an additional day of rest to celebrate the start of a new month based upon the lunar calendar. But what is a place to rest or a place of rest? Does such a place even exist? I was racking my brains to think of an analogy to explain a place of rest, and I couldn't quite think of one which was all-encompassing, so please just work with me on this one. In very simple layman's terms, a place of rest is like a bus stop or an airport or a waiting room at the doctor's or the dentist's. When you are waiting for a bus or an aeroplane, you haven't yet reached your destination, but you're in the place where you need to be in order to proceed on to the next stage of your journey. You are in the right place. You have recognized that you need to be somewhere and you've started to make arrangements. You've taken ownership of a vision to spend time in a different place, that you need to be somewhere for the next season, the next task, the next mission. You've recognized that there's a calling, an inheritance from God that is tied up with being in the right place. And hopefully at the right time, not 38 years later, as the Israelites experienced when they chose to let fear prevent them from entering their promised land. A place of rest is knowing that you are in the center of God's plan for your life. You experience this second type of rest when you have taken responsibility for what you believe you should be doing and you step into your calling. I've heard this type of rest described as dominion rest, as opposed to Sabbath rest, because it's not so much dependent on a specific time or day of the week as it is dependent on taking ownership of where you're supposed to be and walking in that authority. Dominion rest isn't just at the start of a journey. As you board the bus or the aeroplane, and as you land or disembark, you are still in the place where you are meant to be. And dominion rest culminates at the end of the journey when the mission has been accomplished. So it's not just about a physical place or destination. Take today. If I believe that I should be speaking on the topic of rest, and I take ownership of that belief and start to research the various aspects of Shabbat rest and dominion rest, then I will have a peace and a rest as I press in to study. And I will have an even greater peace and rest when this teaching is over, because I have completed that mission. For me, as I walk in my calling to teach Hebrew and to encourage the church, then I am in that place called rest. Our missions may remain constant over a number of years, but the challenges and the battles will vary. If you're a parent, then your mission to nurture and provide for your child will remain constant, but the lessons that you teach, the advice you give, and the challenges you face will continually change and adapt. If you're a soldier, you may be assigned to a different war zone. Come to think of it, actually, parents could maybe think they're in a war zone too, but a soldier may be assigned to a war zone in a different country, but their mission to protect will remain the same. And when they're in their place, doing their job, fulfilling their calling, using all that they have been given to use in that position, whether it be armor, body protection, then they will find a place called rest because they are where they are supposed to be. For many years, I presumed that there was only one type of rest, the Shabbat rest. And then I started to look at the Hebrew words for rest and discovered that this second type of rest is known by an entirely different Hebrew word. So we've already looked at the fact that Shabbat or Sabbath rest essentially means to cease from working, to rest and to celebrate. Our second Hebrew word today is nuach. I dare say the subtitle widget will struggle with nuach, so I will spell it to save any confusion. And in English, I would probably spell it N-U-A-C-H. But we will take a look at the Hebrew hieroglyphics for the word, as they will hopefully give us a better understanding of the concept. So the first letter is N, or Nun, if you are familiar with the Hebrew alphabet. The middle letter is Vav, which can be a V or a W sound in Hebrew. And the final letter is Chet, or Chet, as it's sometimes called, which is the Hebrew letter that sounds like the guttural Ch at the end of Bach. It's more like Bach than the Ch at the start of cheese or chocolate. But I've said, if we break the word down into its hieroglyphics, it will give us the essential DNA of the word. So Nun is the Hebrew word for a seed or a fish. The Israelites were landlovers and they tilled the soil. So for them, a nun was a seed that you could either eat or you could plant in the soil. If you had plenty of soil, then you could do both. It was important to plant seed for the next season, but it took faith to actually bury valuable seed in the ground rather than to keep it in your storehouse for a time when you had no grain. If, on the other hand, you were a Phoenician living on the coast, making your living on the high seas, then your nun was a fish. The same principle applies today. You catch a tiddler, and if you're really hungry, then you might be tempted to eat that sprat or that sardine, or you might have wisdom and faith to place the small fry on the end of your fishing rod and use it as bait to land a larger fish. So when nun appears at the start of a Hebrew word, it suggests that an element of faith is involved in the action. The second letter is a vav, or it's also sometimes known as waw, since V and W are interchangeable in Hebrew. So a vav is the name given to the hooks in the temple which held the temple veil, which incidentally was at least 4 inches thick, so more like a thin mattress than what we tend to think of when we use the word veil. But the vav was a hook or a nail, a thing which connects. The letter vav is often tagged onto the beginning of a word, and it's then translated as and, or but, or then, because it's essentially a connecting word. When the letter vav appears in the middle of a word, it's a hieroglyphic which reminds us that there's a connection between heaven and earth. It quite often actually represents Jesus, the connector between heaven and earth. And then the final letter is the chet, or the cheth. Chet is the Old English word for a fortress. And the letter is basically two parallel vertical lines which are joined across the top. Think of a square with the line across the bottom missing. The cheth teaches us that whatever our lives parallel with what we believe God is doing in our lives, it becomes a strong fortress for us. So if our lives run in harmony with the perfect tov, goodnesses of God's plans and purposes, then he will create a strong fortress around us. On the other hand, when we allow our lives to run outside of God's plan, then whatever we have partnered with will become a stronghold entrapping us. If you are interested in any way in finding out more about the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet and how it can be opened up to reveal the root meanings of so many Hebrew words, then please contact Father's House via Facebook, or you can contact my Facebook page, Discovering Hebrew Gold, or you can find my book, Discovering Hebrew Gold by Roz Boyer on Amazon. Very quick plug, and that is what the book looks like. But anyway, back to looking at the word nuach. It means taking a step of faith, sowing a seed of faith to walk into something that involves becoming a connection between heaven and earth, which will result in our lives running in parallel with the perfect plan and purpose that God has for our lives. Wow, isn't Hebrew a fascinating language? So those three letters of nuach spell out the nun is a step of faith, sowing a seed of faith, to walk into something that involves becoming a connection, a vav between heaven and earth, which will result in our lives running in parallel with the perfect plan and purpose that God has for our lives, that fortress, that's the chayth at the end. And the Hebrew word for that place is nuach. Now that we're starting to familiarize ourselves with the concept of nuach, let's take a look at it within the context of the Bible. Nuach actually appears 67 times in the Old Testament. And I can't believe until this past week, I never came across it before, but I've been up at like 4 or 5 o'clock every morning this week, studying it, absolutely fascinated. The very first occurrence of Nuach is in Genesis 8, verse 4. And that's after the waters subsided and the ark rested in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, upon the mountains of Ararat. It was at that point something stirred in the back of my mind as I remembered that Noah is not the Hebrew pronunciation of his name. If you look up Noah's name in the Hebrew, you will find that it is actually meant to be pronounced Noach with a chet at the end. Sure enough, when I checked Strong's Concordance, I found that Noach and Nuach come from the very same root word. In fact, Noah's name means rest. So while you might have been tempted, if you'd ever heard that fact before, that Noah means rest, you might have thought, huh, maybe it's because he had plenty of time to enjoy his worldwide cruise, feeding and caring for all manner of animals and teaching them to sit and do party tricks. No, Noah's name was actually a prophecy that he would come to rest where God would place him, on the mountains of Ararat between Turkey and Iran. The mission wasn't over when Noah arrived on dry ground. In fact, the ground was probably more of a swamp, a scene of utter destruction. The flood had caused chaos, but Noah was in the place where he and his ark had come to rest. The next instance of Noah is found in Exodus 17, verse 11, when Joshua was defeating the Amalekites. I'm just going to begin reading at verse 10, and that's Exodus chapter 17. So Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek, while Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. Whenever Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed. And whenever he let it down, or nuached his hand, then Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands grew weary, so he took a stone and put it under him, or they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it, while Aaron and Hur held up his hands, one on each side and the other on the other side. So he was able to rest. What was going on here? Moses was in the right place at the right time, but he'd grown tired of standing there in his own strength, doing it on his own, holding his hands up high. In fact, come to think of it, what difference would it have made to the battle if Moses had just stood and watched from a safe distance and let his hands fall? It wasn't as if Joshua's troops were basically noticing or taking a quick coffee break just to check, does Moses still have his hands up? God was fighting the battle on behalf of his people. If Moses could have stood there all day, then maybe Moses would have received all the credit and all the acclamation. But he needed to learn to rest, to make use of the rock, which Aaron and Hur placed below him, and allowed them to hold his hands up. It wasn't a solo effort. They were a tribe working together. Nuach appears again towards the end of Exodus in chapter 33, when Moses entered the tent of meeting, the tabernacle. God told him in verse 14, "My presence will go with you, In fact, there is no Hebrew word for presence. The word is pane or panim, which means my face or my faces will go with you, and I will give you rest, nuach. We aren't going to go through all 67 instances of the word, you will be pleased to hear, though I do plan to go through them in my own personal time. But I just want to draw our attention to a couple more verses. I know this is quite a new concept for most of us to get our heads around, so that's why I call this message a time and a place. So if that is all you remember from today, it's that there is a time to rest, but there's also a place called rest. When something is important within a culture, then you do tend to find that the language has numerous words to describe it. Take, for example, a curry. Way back when I was a child in the last century, if you went out for a meal, you might have picked a curry from the menu if you were feeling adventurous. But a curry was a curry. We had no idea what options or subtleties of flavour were possible. So the only clarification I was ever aware of was whether it was a Chinese curry or an Indian curry. And an Indian curry was too hot. So basically, a curry was a Chinese curry. Nowadays, we are much more aware of the options available, such as jalfrezi, tandoori, vindaloo, balti, biryani, masala, korma, madras, or just a chip with curry sauce. Curry has always been important in India, and that is reflected in the fact that they have so many names for this dish, and we have only adopted all these names over the past 30-odd years. Just as curry is important in India, rest has always been so important to God, and that is why there are numerous nuances on the word rest. Genesis 2 verse 2 is a very familiar verse, and on the seventh day God finished his work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all the work that he had done. I've made the distinction between the Shabbat, which is the time, the seventh day, and Nuach, which is a place of rest, as it's easier to get our heads around these two ideas. But in actual fact, Shabbat is essentially to cease from work and to celebrate, whereas Nuach, you could actually be in the middle of being busy and working, but you find rest in the midst of it because you're in the place where you're meant to be and you have taken dominion or authority or responsibility to be where God has called you to be. So Genesis 2 verse 2 tells us that God rested on the seventh day, i.e. he Shabbatted on the seventh day. He ceased working and he celebrated on the seventh day. Whereas in Exodus 20 verse 11, Moses is speaking about the same event, but he says, "For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth and all that is in them, and rested, nuacht." So God found rest in the midst of the busyness, because he had taken all authority and dominion over his creation, his sphere of influence, which is the earth, and all the universes beyond. God was the supreme example of what it means to nuach, right back there in creation. Moving forwards through the Old Testament, if you want to take it further, here are a few more examples of places where people took a nuach rest because their lives were on track and they took responsibility to be where God would have them be. In Numbers 10, verses 34 to 36, we hear how the cloud of the Lord was over the Israelites by day whenever they set out from the camp. And whenever the Ark of the Covenant set out, Moses said, "Arise, O Lord, and let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee before you." And when the Ark of the Covenant rested, nuacht, he said, "Return, O Lord, to the 10,000s of Israel," the million Israelites who were walking through the wilderness. So the Ark of the Covenant came to rest. It nuacht in the place where it was meant to be. Do you know, it would be an interesting exercise to just pick up a Bible concordance or look up an online Bible interlinear such as Bible Hub or Blue Letter Bible and make a note of all of the instances of the word nuach, for it's like God has taken a highlighter pen with his word to show the great master plan for mankind. You can see things where people were just slotting into the place where they were supposed to be at the right time. Numbers 11 verse 25, when the 70 elders were appointed to aid Moses, we read that Moses gathered 70 of the elders around the tabernacle. Then the Lord came down in the cloud and spoke to him and took some of the spirit that was on him and put it on the 70 elders. And as soon as the spirit rested on them, nuacht on them, they prophesied. So just as God, Father God, Creator God, rested at creation on the seventh day, The spirit rested or nuacht on the 70 elders. It was a sign that appointing the 70 elders was part of God's plan, God's master plan. The journey, their mission wasn't over, but there was a nuach rest in the midst of the wilderness as the Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit, rested upon them. The book of Deuteronomy recounts all that had happened in the wilderness years and how the people rebelled and then defeated some of their arch enemies. And in Deuteronomy 3, verse 18, Moses reminds the Israelites, "And I commanded you at that time, saying, the Lord your God has given you this land to possess. All your men of valor shall cross over, armed before your brothers, the people of Israel. Only your wives, your little ones, your livestock shall remain in the cities that I have given you." Verse 20, "Until the Lord gives rest, nuach rest, a place to take responsibility and dominion over, to your brothers and to you, and they also occupy the land that the Lord has given them beyond the Jordan." One of my favorite verses that I came across was Joshua 3, verse 13, when Israel crossed the Jordan, when they finally crossed the Jordan, the 12 priests who were carrying the ark, they began to step into the river. And we read that when the soles of the feet of the priests bearing the ark of the Lord of all the earth shall rest in the waters of the Jordan. The waters of the Jordan shall be cut off from flowing, and the waters coming down from above shall stand in one heap. The Israelites were always meant to cross over into their promised land. The name Eber, from which we get the name Hebrew, literally means to cross over. And in actual fact, the name Abraham or Avram is also coming from that root word, meaning to cross over, way back at the beginning. The Ark of the Lord symbolized the presence of Yahweh in their midst. And whenever the priests carrying that ark set foot in the river Jordan to cross over, whenever the soles of their feet rested on the riverbed, which marked the boundary, when they stepped into the place where they were meant to be, they experienced a sign and a wonder as the waters coming down from upstream were cut off and stood as a heap, just as the waters of the Red Sea had done. And you might think, did it really matter that the waters stopped? But when you're carrying something large and heavy and as important as the Ark of the Covenant, if things had gone wrong, even if the waters had stopped and then they'd suddenly started flowing again, this huge wall of water, somebody could have got trapped below the Ark. Like, it was life and death. God was there in their midst. Just to take the word nuach one final step further and give you a quick bit of Hebrew understanding. When the letter M, or mem as it's called in Hebrew, is prefixed or added to the start of a word, then it means in or inside. It's a bit like the prefix inter that we have in English. For example, we talk about intercity, international. So if we put the letter mem in front of the root word nuach, we get the word menucha, which is Hebrew for a resting place. If the word menucha sounds a little bit familiar to you, then yes, it is very similar to the word manuka, as in the really expensive honey. Today we associate manuka honey with New Zealand, but it's interesting to note that the people of Israel were called to menucha, the place of milk and honey. And it's certainly a good way to remember the Hebrew word for a resting place, menucha. Incidentally, I have been looking up and I've come across quite a few Maori words which are virtually identical to the Hebrew, which lends even more credence to the argument that we were all descended from an original people group and shared a common language spoken by Noah and his sons, who were told to go forth and multiply. But I digress. If you're wondering where the word menucha occurs, a prime example is Deuteronomy 12, verses 8 and 9. "You shall not do according to all that you are doing here today, everyone doing what is right in their own eyes, for you have not as yet come to the rest, the menucha, the resting place, and to the inheritance that the Lord your God is giving you." Note that you can be in the right place, but you can still be doing what is right in your own eyes. And until you bring your heart into line too, then you will find no rest. When we do right in our own eyes, we will always be able to find someone who's going to agree with us that our plans do have merit, and we always find a way to try to justify our actions. But the blessing lifted from the Israelites when they chose to do what was right in their own eyes, even though they were in a place where they should have found their rest, their resting place. As I bring this into land, for I could spend weeks looking at all the instances of Nuach rest, the place of rest, where we are in the center of God's plan for our lives, I am reminded of the word shalom, which of course means peace and wholeness, but it too carries the idea of rest, as I mentioned from the verse when we talked about the wicked not finding rest or shalom. In Israel, shalom is a greeting, like hello or goodbye, and it can actually mean both. Shalom is a greeting, but it's also a blessing, speaking peace and wholeness to the recipient. Just as in our English expression, goodbye, originated from the expression, God be with you. So why do peace and rest matter? Have we been so influenced by the rat race, the pressure that we always need to be defending our existence, justifying the fact that we have things to do by emphasizing how busy we are, that we're too important? Our role has actually become that we cannot stop to pause and rest. We cannot take the Sabbath. We cannot celebrate. Peace and rest are vital if we're going to have any longevity in our lives. Most people will concede that peace between us and our neighbours is a good thing. After all, when we live in harmony, as Psalm 133 says, how good and pleasant it is when brothers dwell in unity, for there the Lord has commanded a blessing, life forevermore. But it is vital that we know peace and rest for ourselves, within ourselves. It isn't selfish for us to rest and to find peace for ourselves. Maybe your friends and family don't understand why you believe that you should take a rest on a Saturday or a Sunday or even a Monday, for that's the day most people involved with ministry try to take a day off, despite the fact that the rest of the world seems to be up and at it, trying to hit the road running on a Monday morning. But it isn't just a lifestyle choice. The purpose of the peace of God is to guard your heart so that you can always hear God and respond accordingly. When you can hear God, then you are ready to walk in authority. While they may not see it or even understand it, everyone gets blessed when you are in that place, when you take a Sabbath rest, a Shabbat rest, when you are in the place of rest where God wants you to be, when the Holy Spirit has rested upon you, when the power of God is holding back the waters for you to carry the presence of God into a new place. The blessing and the favor of God go with us as we walk in dominion rest, staying on the paths that God has ordained for us as we possess the land. Shabbat and Nuach are a time to rest and a place to rest, a position of rest. Amen.